cops identified the agents as Deputy Chief of the Federal Police in Iguala, Guerrero, Luis Antonio Dorantes, and Deputy Inspector José Carlos Hernández. However, according to official records, five other alleged Federal Police suspects have also been identified, although not yet linked directly to the incident. In fact, according to Hernández, there is conclusive proof that the Federal Police was already surveilling the students since the day prior to the tragic disappearance. In his report, Dorantes says the surveillance was meant to prevent any violent act and as for backup of state police. Hernández also revealed that all arrests and confessions in the Ayotzinapa case were based on torturing members of the United Warriors in order to coerce them into saying what the government wanted them to say.
Thousands of people have staged a demonstration in the Mexican capital to express their outrage at the government's response to the massacre of 43 students in 2014. Some 2,000 protesters, including parents and relatives of the victims, gathered in Mexico City on Tuesday carrying small torches as well as black and white photos of the 43 students. The students disappeared on September the 26th, 2014, after participating in a protest in the southwestern city of Iguala, Guerrero State. The Mexican government says the missing students were kidnapped by corrupt municipal policemen and handed over to the local drug gang Guerreros Unidos. The gang apparently massacred them and burned their bodies at a garage dump and dropped their remains in a nearby river, a government investigation concluded. Relatives of the victims, however, dismissed the government version of the incident. A group of international experts from the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights cast doubt on the government account of the incident in a number of reports. In a report on Sunday, the panel said the government's stonewalling stopped them from preaching the truth.
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
This is Jen Gorlick. I'm an activist in D.C. I support a free and unoccupied Palestine, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Okay, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the official broadcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service. It's become more of a issue than it really probably should be, but politics being what it is, and politics surrounding the existence of the State of Israel as a Jewish state being what it is, Zionism again, and the issue of anti-Semitism, which we really, I always identify on this broadcast as Judeophobia, because if you're Arab, you're a Semite. So, you know, that's something else that we can get into for another time. But ex-mayor of London, Ken Livingston, he's been having his keister kicked up around his shoulders as of late because he pointed out a historical fact that has been used and misused. And that historical fact is that the far right of the Zionist movement, anyone who understands the history of Lehi, the history of the Irgun, during the early Zionist days of occupied Palestine under the British mandate, you might remember, these were the people who were known for destroying the King David Hotel and killing numbers of people. That this was the organization, along with the Haganah, that was implicated for the assassination of Count Foch Bernadotte. There were numerous assassinations of British military personnel, assassinations of other Jews that they didn't see as being 100% with their revisionist Zionist program to remove the Palestinian population, to replace it with the European and disparate Jewish population in the Arab world. What Ken Livingstone was referring to was the Havara Agreement, the written understanding between the Zionist movement and Nazi Germany to transfer Jews from Germany and the Sudetenland, if I remember correctly, and other parts of German-speaking Europe, basically the areas that were under their control, to transfer them to Palestine, so that basically this would be the founding of the Jewish state. Now, anyone within the Zionist movement is aware of this, but that truth isn't really being discussed. You can actually go to the Israeli site for Lehi. Yes, they still have a site, even though the group does not exist anymore, but the Freedom Fighters of Israel Heritage Association, FFI Lehi. If you go to the page referring to foreign relations during World War II, it discusses it right there, and there's even a photograph of the actual document, Lehi proposal of collaboration with Nazi Germany. It was a political move. It was a political move. They were trying to get many of their people into occupied Palestine because it's part of their plan, right? They were people without a land. If you look at it objectively, you can understand the politics behind it. They were smuggling their people in. I mean, look at the history. But at the same time, today that is considered an embarrassment. We see what is happening in occupy Palestine today. We see what is happening, what is known as the State of Israel today. We're looking at the genocide of Palestinian people. The two-state solution that was supposedly agreed to in 1948, partition, that never happened. And I have to say, we're going to have a hard time getting through this show. Not because I don't understand what's happening, and not because my guest doesn't understand what we do. But it's a hard issue. I'm part Jewish. This is a hard issue to discuss. You know, in a way, I sort of feel like Hannah Arendt. Because, you know, what are you supposed to do? Ignore what you see? Or do you be objective so you can understand how it happened so that it doesn't happen again? And in this case, we're looking at a group of people who have been victimized, who have basically become victimizers. And they've used their own history of abuse to justify the abuse that they're now using against other people. Now, why did I mention all of that, and why did I say it the way I said it? It has to be laid out that the propaganda, you know, because we can say Zionist lobby, but, you know, in a lot of ways that's unfair. The Zionist movement in and of itself is not a bad thing. You know, I mean, you know, European Jews had a right to survive. They had a right to defend themselves. You know, anyone who understands the history of the Pale, anyone who understands the history of the pogroms and understands the fact historically that it was the Catholic Church that started all of this, even though that is not being discussed. You know, I mean, if you talk to the average person on the street today, anywhere in the Anglophone world, you know, that you would think that Jewish sentiment started in Europe through Islam. That's not true. When Islam was in Europe, in the period otherwise known as Al-Andalus, Jews, Christians, Muslims lived together, kept their religious bits, and moved forward. Now, was it perfect? I have absolutely no idea if it was a perfect society, but I do know that they moved forward. They were integrated in such a way, and when the Catholics took over, they stopped that. It was the Catholics who ejected the Jews in 1942. It was the Catholics that started the pogroms. Right, and they also slaughtered as many Muslims as possible in Spain. That is the history of things. But again, if you have the background of that and you understand that, you understand the difference between hating Jews for being Jews and the difference between, you know, looking at the State of Israel as a political entity and criticizing it as a political entity, that there is a difference. But the Zionist movement and those that are really hardline revisionist Zionists, this is not my term, Zev Yabotinsky, again, look this up. Do not believe me. Vladimir Zev Yabotinsky wrote what is called the Iron Wall in the 1920s. That has been the blueprint for Zionist ideas of taking over Palestine. Because before that, it was the Uganda plan. How many of you know that? There were two plans for Paraguay. They couldn't find the funding. The British government played for the Uganda plan, but it failed. So then they finally decided on Palestine after a period of time. And again, this was a political move because the British-Israeli movement, and we've just talked about this, General Allenby, when he walked into Palestine, he walked in on foot. He did so because he was a British-Israeli. They believed that the British people, and there's still a handful of them out there, believed that the British people are the true Jews of the Bible. So when he was coming in, he was claiming Palestine for Britain, for Britain's Jews. You understand what I'm saying here? And then because of a weird freak in history, those of you who speak Arabic would know that Allenby, even though, you know, his name was Allenby, General Allenby, well, in Arabic, it's Allenby, the prophet. So when the British walked in on foot, out of respect, see, these are complications that lead to the history that we're talking about now. What I'm trying to say is, brothers and sisters, when we talk about Israel, we've been cornered into looking at this, that Israel represents Jews and that Zionism as a whole represents Jews, and ignores the fact that there's as much diversity politically, ideologically, even on the religious tip between Jews. But again, looking at it historically and looking at how Jews have been treated by Europe is the most powerful, whatever. Well, okay. Let's take that for granted just so we all are on the same level here. So if we're coming from on the same page, let's assume that it really is a white world. Well, the white world hasn't treated Jews very well, you know, for whatever reason. You know, it can't really be because of how they look, because they look like other Europeans to most people who are not European. And that's real talk. You ask the average person who was not from, you know, does not live around white people, did not grow up around white people, did not have anything to do with white, you know, media. The all white folks look the same, you know, and they don't see the differences. And you start to really ask, because you get all kinds of racist theories to come in about the Khazars, which there's probably some, I mean, it has to be to a degree. They had to have intermixed with the other people that they met, of course. That's what happened in Spain. That's what happened in Gaul. Oh, of course. But politically speaking, in the 20th century, we've been stuck with a really false meme that to question the state of Israel is to question the existence of Jews altogether, which pretty much leaves this particular issue in this particular subject in such a neither world of bullshit that we can't actually have a discussion, because you have religion wrapped up into an ethnic identity. I'm a quarter Jew, and it's like, what? Is it a religion? Well, I don't practice the religion. Is it a culture? Well, there kind of is a culture, but I just said, you have Mizrahi, you have Ashkenazim, which I am, right? It's all split up. Sephardic, you know, I mean, there's even different languages. My family spoke Yiddish. If your family was from Spain, they spoke Ladino, I believe it's called. We don't speak the same languages. Mizrahi, Jews speak Arabic. We've been split up. This says my indigenous brothers and sisters, my African brothers and sisters in the colonial states, we have been split up. But for a strange reason that really isn't so strange, the subject of the state of Israel being a white European outpost in the Middle East, or what is supposed to be the Middle East, right? The middle of what? Otherwise known as oil-rich Western Asia. When we look at the history of World War I, and why Europe wanted to control this region, and how fascists on both sides sent in their agents during World War I. You never heard Arabs talk about Jews as being people of the devil until they learned this from the Germans and the Italians. How do I know this? Because I just wrote about it in Efforts for Fascism. Go get yourself a copy. This is real talk. This, you know, issue is so fucking confused, I don't even know where to begin, let alone to end. And since I've talked enough, and I, like I said, I did all of that in a very weak attempt to try to lay some kind of a foundation for what we're going to talk about. Because we're going to talk about propaganda. We're going to talk about hate. We're going to talk about politics. We're going to talk about how the politics of the far right tend to take things like this and twist it in such a way that nobody can see anything. And then before we know, we've got two black eyes and they're in charge. And while we're hating each other and running around, you know, they're in charge. We're watching it in India. Look at the violence that happened under President Modi before he got in with the RSS. What the hell is going on here? So, again, I apologize to my guest, Krusty Alsop. Welcome to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's very nice to be here.
Yes, so I'm very sorry about all that talk on the way in, but I was trying to lay some sort of a background, because most people do not know the far right within the Jewish political sphere in terms of Zionism worked with the far right of the people who were trying to eliminate them as a group in Europe because of political expediency. And when Ken Livingstone mentioned that, he lost his position and he's really been pummeled ever since. What is your take on that in terms of Labour being called now the most anti-Semitic organization in British history? Somebody actually said that.
I think it's laughable, to be honest with you. it's beyond parody, if you want, for want of a better word. I mean, let's get something straight here. I've done a lot of reading around what's been going on in the last few days, and you know, Ken Livingstone, I've known of him for a long time. I used to come to London before I lived here. I've been in this city for 25 years, and I used to come to this city as a teenager, used to attend sort of anti-racism gigs, anti-racism events, and this was at the height of Thatcher years, and Ken Livingstone was trying to humanize a very inhuman city, and for him to be called an anti-Semite is laughable. And I think sometimes what he does is, I think he's had so many enemies over the years, for whatever reason, I think that he has become a target and people have been out to get him. And in a way, I think he's kind of gone, oh, fuck it, I'll give them what they want. But not, I don't even think he said, oh, I'll give them what they want. I don't think he means it. I think he was clumsy, and this is what a lot of people have been saying, that he was clumsy in what he was trying to say. But I think if you've been fighting people all your life who are determined to distribute and disseminate misinformation about something that is very serious and very important, that has a resonance with all of us, then, you know, I think sometimes it wears you down. I mean, he's like, what, 70 odd?
Yeah.
And, he was the person who introduced, people forget this about him, you know. He introduced things like, you know, better representation for women, for people of colour, for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people. He was a forerunner about having a really inclusive society that wasn't based on any kind of race, class, religious, or any other distinction. And I think what has happened is that he has been a thorn in the side of people who have been determined to try and destroy him. And I'm sort of reminded, in a way, of when he was fighting Boris Johnson, our lovely mayor that we have at the moment, from the upper classes, eighth cousin to the Queen, born in America, not even born in the country, has made multiple obnoxious racist statements, outpourings, attacks on working class people of any nationality. You know, his favourite phrase seems to be calling black people pickaninnies, which is probably one of the most obnoxious. And he may well have used the N-word that, you know, we don't want to discuss here. I can't even bear to say it. One of our sort of leading so-called liberal left-wing journalists, Jonathan Friedland, did an absolute hatchet job on. That was a real wake-up call for me about what kind of weird sort of parallel universe we have going on. We have a fight going on. There's a fight about creating information that is not right, and about rubbing out free speech. This is what I think. And I think we have this bizarre situation now that we're in, with all this kind of blow up about anti-Semitism and what Ken said, and he got the year wrong about this, you know, this agreement between Adolf Hitler and the Zionists about getting all the Jews out of Germany to go to Israel and all the rest of it. And I think if he wanted to write a comedy show that was the most, the blackest of black comedies, this is what you would use as your material to describe it. That's what I think. but what really upset me at that point about Jonathan Friedland was not the fact that he was doing anything that was remotely left any open any option. It was about destroying Ken Livingstone, and you know the and Boris Johnson won by a very slim majority. So what that means is that people who do not lead straightened lives, as many of us do, difficult lives where we're all fighting through, where we're involved in other people's lives, where everybody is fighting through, there is this kind of overt attack on a single person in order to preserve a status quo that, quite frankly, is warped. And Israel has become the focus, or anti-Semitism has become the focus, but actually it's puffery and bullshit. It's total puffery and bullshit.
Well, as I'm looking at right here, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but right here, as I can see right here, this is Haaretz. And this was the 30th, and they're saying ex-London mayor cites Netanyahu's Mufti comments to defend Zionist Hitler claim. Well, see, they're pretending that there was no link. Now, as I mentioned on the way in here, the Havar Agreement is just one. The links between Lehi and the Haganah and the Irgun and the Italian and German fascists, he didn't even mention that.
Yeah.
See, he didn't even talk about that. So, you know, for a Israeli newspaper to say that is the way that they did it, and I can understand why they did it, but... now, what they're saying here, and I've seen this myself through the BBC and Sky News, is that Ken Livingstone says that he's sorry for the furor that, you know, that has come up, but that he said what I said was true, and then I'm not gonna not say that it's not true, because it did happen, and he is right, it did happen, and let me correct myself. They do have a link here beneath this story that says Livingstone 6 to his remarks, and there's a book that says that he's correct, at least, but it's the way they did it. It's a sort of backhanded acknowledgement. Livingstone sticks to Zionist Hitler remarks, says Marx's book proves him right. It's not just the Marxist book. I just read off, and anyone who doesn't believe me can go check my Twitter feed at The Angry Indian. Lehi themselves say that they tried to work with the Nazis because they were trying to use political expediency to get as many of their people out and to found their country, which is they needed people in order to do that. And if they had to make a deal with the devil, they were going to do that. So Ken Livingstone was right. You know, the rest of this is just nonsense.
Well, I'm probably going to get it in the neck on my Twitter feed about this, but. You know, I mean, everybody who is a politician, as which Ken Livingstone is, has issues, and they're arseholes, and they do shit things, and they say the wrong thing and everything. But I do think we live in an immediate world where, you know, people see what happens now is people see a headline or a byline or something. They respond to that, and they don't actually respond to the reality, or that there is no discussion, there is no real factually based, proper, open debate. The parameters of debate have been so contracted that something like this, which has happened in the last few days about the Labour Party, has become it walks on its own. It's like a, you know, they create a leviathan of rubbish, which is totally divorced from reality and totally divorced from history. And I think what somebody like Ken Livingstone is doing is trying to in a way, precipitate a wider debate. But because the majority of the media is so devoted to shutting down debating, keeping it in a very, very narrow confine to present one political idea, there's no debate. And then it just becomes this whole, how do I call it, a confection of lies, misrepresentation, misinterpretation.
Yeah, well, see, that's why I was so long-winded on the way in here, because there's so many details that if you don't know, it's really, you know, hard to make an educated and informed decision on what you're hearing. Now, when I mentioned the Havara Agreement, just not to insult Jews, because, you know, that they made this deal with the Nazis. It happened. I can understand why.
Yeah.
You know, I can understand why. You know, looking at it objectively, you can understand why. You can also understand, objectively speaking, why Lehi, Irgun, and the Haganah were trying to make deals with the fascists, because they were fighting the British. Okay, you can understand why. I mean, the IRA did the same thing. They also, two factions worked with the Nazis during World War II against British interests. Yeah, I mean, how many people think about that and bring this in? But, you know, as we're going into this, you know, one other thing I want to clarify. I mentioned the Mufti in that, title from Haaretz, but I didn't really get into that. For those who don't know, in the background, the Grand Mufti, or the mayor, the head of Palestine at that particular time, al-Husseini, he really went beyond his opposition to Aliyah. I mean, he really hated Jews. He really had an ethnic hate. He had a personal bias against Jewish people. So, and other Arabs, actually, you know, who would, he didn't feel were elevated. But my point is that because he was opposed to the British, who were invading his country, he was willing to work with the Nazis.
Yeah.
And he was taken over to Eastern Europe. He met with Hitler. And they gave him a salary. They actually made him a general. And he recruited Muslims in Eastern Europe to, like, the Ustasha. If you really want to talk about, you know, hatred, I mean, these people killed as many Jews and Serbs as they can. But in the United States, that history isn't taught. And so when they hear that the Grand Mufti was involved and recruited Muslims, they think that he brought Arabs over. Because so many people in the United States are totally unaware that Islam is a major religion, just as much as Buddhism is in Eastern Europe. And he didn't have too much trouble getting Bosnian Muslims, who already hated Serbs, as much as they hate Jews, as much as they hated Rom people, or Gypsies, as they're still known in this country, but they're known amongst themselves as Rom people. You know, that history isn't known. So, you know, it makes it seem as if, you know, Islam, that Arab Muslims were coming over to Europe to kill Jews. That's not what happened. He was recruiting people who were already Muslim to work with the Nazis. And, of course, they were killing anybody who didn't fit their ethnic idea of, you know, whatever the hell was going on. And in terms of the Ustasha in Croatia, they were led by Anton Pavelić, who was as anti-Serb and anti-Jewish as you could possibly be. They killed as many Gypsy or Rom people as possible as well. So, you know, when people are criticizing Ken Livingstone and Nasr Shah, because, you know, if we really get into the discussion about Nasr Shah, I mean, what exactly was she being accused of? Comparing Zionism to Al-Qaeda? That's really not what she did. And I can even read the quote here, because you read the same article. In my view, Zionism, like Al-Qaeda, was and is a political movement laid with religious symbolism that was, in the case of Zionism, responding to a millennia or more of European pogroms, persecution by people who were fueled by hatred and need to find excuse to persecute Jews. Zionism used this and the colonial period to groom other modernized men and women of Jewish descent to exert political influence at the highest levels of public office by using the guilt of the pogroms and offer the solution to the Jewish question in Europe. That's not a comparison. The only comparison she made is that they were both political religious movements made up, in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, of people who don't even really believe in their faiths. Because, you know, when you look at the extremist Islamic terrorists, They drink. They have illicit sex with prostitutes or women that they attack. They sell women, you know. They justify a lot of this through their religion. There's a lot of pederasty that goes on in Afghanistan and a lot of these extremist groups. There's no women in there, right? They take advantage of the young people sexually. We know this because there's been documentation of this. There's a documentary about this right now, talking about what's going on in Afghanistan, the Dancing Boys of Afghanistan. So, you know, they're hypocrites in the religious sense. And if you actually, you know, read the Quran and ask anybody who's knowledgeable, the killing of women and children and the infirm is illegal, is immoral. So they're hypocrites. So then you look at, you know, the same thing going on with Judaism. Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism, who was somebody who didn't, you know, frankly, and also for people who don't know the background, he was a European Jew. He was born in Hungary, but he was not religious. He was very secular. He considered himself a European. He admitted this in his own book, The State, The Judenstaat. He's like, I didn't believe in any of this. But after he got, you know, treated badly and was forced to remember that he was a Jew during the L'affaire Dreyfus, the Dreyfus affair, Alfred Dreyfus's trial. And for those who aren't hip on that and not ready, go look up on your Google the Dreyfus affair. This was a French lieutenant who got in trouble. It was a military scandal, and because he was Jewish, it became not just a class issue of the military versus, you know, this particular soldier. It became, you know, Jews versus the French state, the safety of the French state. They used racism, you dig what I'm saying, to get their political movement to crack down with more conservatism. They used this case to whip up hatred against Jews. The same thing that happened when the original protocols of the Elders of Zion was released. It was created by the Tsarist secret police. King Nicholas needed to have a scandal. He needed to get rid of his Jewish population, and he had to find a way to explain things, blame it on them. And the secret police took it, basically copied a morality play from France, word for word almost. Anybody can go do the research on this to get a political point across. When Kissinger, really, who started this, said in the 1970s that Israel has a God-given right to exist, he knew that religion and race in the political end were going to be used. Because it's hard to question either. You'll either be accused of being an atheist, which nobody wants to be hit with that, even if you are an atheist, right? It makes life difficult, doesn't it? Right? Or you don't want to be related to anything that had to do with anything that went on in the European Holocaust. And politically, it's being misused. And that's exactly what Nasha said. And that's exactly what Ken Livingston is saying. And that's exactly what my guest is saying, too. And we're going to take a break.
Okay.
We're going to take a break. Because when we come back, Krusty Allsop is going to bring in the Hillsborough incident.
Okay.
In terms of how, you know, politics are being swayed by things that we really care about very, very deeply. Many people lost their lives in that incident. And for many of my American listeners, it's something we might have read about when it happened, and it was kind of off our radar. But, you know, when we came in with this, Krusty actually made a pretty good point in terms of what's happening with labor since Jeremy Corbyn has been in. They're doing their best to take him down. They want to get him out. She mentioned Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson is dreaming at night, I think, on how he can get rid of labor. You know, Cameron just got caught up in the Panama Papers and said that he won't step down. This is the sort of politics we're looking at, ladies and gentlemen, especially those of us in the States. We're dealing with Donald Trump, and we've seen what happened with the DNC because Hillary Clinton is no different. Her campaign has worked overtime to badjack it and discredit Bernie Sanders. They have stolen votes. They have kept people from, you know, being registered. They have worked along with the conservatives here. They are conservatives in the Democratic Party who are working with, you know, the far right here to stay in power. You know, even, you know, one of the Koch brothers has now said that he's supporting Hillary Clinton. What does that tell you? And then we see the attacks that are happening against labor, how they're pulling, you know, anti-Semitism against labor, really? Krusty, before we go into our break, I don't remember, you know, but, you know, just for clarity's sake, was Mosley a liberal? Was he part of labor?
Apparently he was in the beginning. He was part of the Labour Party in the beginning. He's from the upper classes, as you well know. He was an aristocrat. But he was in the Labour Party, but he was got rid of very quickly, or he dumped it very quickly. And because he thought that was in a way that Nigel Farage works, you know, I'm a friend of the working man. Yeah, that old bullshit line. Kind of like I'd say Boris Johnson is more Enoch Powell than even Nigel Farage. Nigel Farage is a very short man who has got a lot of contacts, and, you know, people give him some. He's a puppet. He's a little puppet, you know. Farage is a kind of. Oh God, he's a joke, really, in a way. He's not, but he is. He's a jumped up little turd from. It was a stockbroker, you know. He's kind of. But the real danger are people like Boris Johnson and, you know, David Cameron, George Osborne, all related to the Queen. Who else? Jeremy Hunt, you know, the one who's currently crucifying the junior doctors, also related to the Queen. You know, we have some. It's like we've gone back 100 years in this country. You know, this is what it's like. It's very, very peculiar times to be living in. But Farage is, I mean, he's not funny. I wouldn't say he was funny, but he's useful.
About as funny as Donald Trump, then.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so when we come back, we'll be with still Krusty Allsop, and we're going to work in the Hillsborough disaster. We're going to work in, you know, just the sort of propaganda, the far right, the political things that start to happen when they're trying to get power. Weird things happen. And we're going to talk about it more. Stick around. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Stay tuned.
This is Malachi Daniels, talking to you from New York City. You're listening to Aboriginal News, Angry Indian Radio, a place where you can come to hear what's really critical, and discuss about African people, about Indigenous people, what is going on globally, where you can come and get real information. This is not CNN. This is not even RT or STV. This is Aboriginal News. Come and get it.
St. Marie. We have overcome many obstacles in our history as Aboriginal people. We've survived. Today, we must work together, become leaders in the fight to stop the spread of HIV/AIDS in our communities. We have to think about the 7 generations ahead of us. It's a matter of survival.
Mike Cadell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas, smack dab between Kansas City, Topeka, Lawrence, Atchison. Easiest way to describe it. Put together quite a good show. I think you're going to like it.
Radio Free Kansas on blogtalkradio.com/HideInCopfire.
In articles acknowledging the one-year anniversary of the assault on Gaza, blunt and unsparing language is rare. Despite sympathy and support for the Palestinian people, the description of what took place in January 2009 is sometimes buffered by a misguided sense of political correctness. Yes, it's terrible. Yes, it is unjust. But we don't want to be inflammatory or risk offending the sensitivities of those who, through their own willful ignorance, cling to the notion that Israel is a victim state, fighting for its very survival. This commentary is more forthright. Gaza, in plain language. The sociopathic Zionist administration of Israel, as part of its continuing brutal colonization of Palestine, deliberately devastated the already nearly incapacitated infrastructure which supports the existence of 1.5 million refugees. The people of Gaza, second, third, and fourth generation dispossessed Palestinians, are living in forced exile from land their families inhabited and cultivated for generations. Half of them are children under the age of 15. Their culture and their economy has been systematically ravaged by Israel for decades, and since 2006, a criminal siege, supported by the United States, as well as much of the international community, has deprived them of all but the most minimal resources for subsistence. This oppressed and brutalized population was bombed, bulldozed, and terrorized mercilessly for 23 days. What follows is a small sampling of facts concerning the barbaric actions which one of the most powerful military machines in the world took against a captive and defenseless population. If the reality presented here goes beyond the stretch of your imagination, you can verify the data yourself with a few simple Google searches. Though you'd better hurry, much of this information seems to be disappearing down Google's memory hole, just as is the fate of the people of Gaza. You may discover that exact figures vary somewhat depending on the source, but whether it was 21,000 structures or 22,000 structures destroyed, whether 280 schools were destroyed or badly damaged versus 230, the overwhelming truth of the physical devastation which took place in Gaza and the fact that this destruction was deliberate and premeditated is irrefutable. Even the Goldstone Report, itself a document with severe pro-Zionist overtones, issued by a declared Zionist and a supporter of Israel, states unequivocally, "The deliberate actions of the Israeli forces and the declared policies of the government of Israel cumulatively indicate the intention to inflict collective punishment on the people of the Gaza Strip in violation of international humanitarian law." We've heard, time and again, that more than 1,400 Palestinians were killed, over 80% of them civilians, including 342 children. These figures have become a familiar talking point in discussions of last year's assault, so much so that they may have lost their impact. But what we are not often reminded of is the horrific level of carefully planned destruction of civilian infrastructure in Gaza orchestrated by Israel during Operation Cast Lead. Financed and armed by the United States, the Israeli military destroyed 15% of the structures in Gaza, approximately 22,000 buildings, including 5,300 housing units, destroyed or subject to major damage. Another 52,000 homes receive some form of structural damage. Over 200 factories and 700 stores and businesses were destroyed or badly damaged. Of the residences, factories, and businesses completely destroyed, 1,300 of the homes and approximately 25% of the commercial property were deliberately and painstakingly bulldozed or exploded by Israeli ground forces. 8 hospitals and 26 primary health care clinics were damaged or destroyed. More than 280 schools were damaged or destroyed. Water and sewage treatment facilities, as well as electricity infrastructure, were deliberately targeted, leaving vast segments of the population with little or no power or clean water for the duration of the assault and for weeks and months to follow. Massive amounts of agricultural lands were systematically bombed or bulldozed.
When the Israelis invaded the Gaza Strip, they came straight in here. I've covered earthquakes, hurricanes, and the tsunami. And what has happened here is as bad or worse than anything I've seen in any of those. And this was done by Israeli bulldozers.
Some estimates suggest that as much as 80% of the arable land in Gaza has been ruined or declared off-limits to the people of Gaza over the last decade. 2 million liters of wastewater from Gaza City's sewage treatment plant, bombed during the assault, leaked into surrounding agricultural land, making it unusable. An Israeli television station boasted that Israeli warplanes alone, without accounting for tank, ground troop, and warship ammunition, dropped approximately 1,000 tons of bombs on Gaza during Operation Cast Lead. The effort involved months, if not years, of carefully considered target selection, giving the lie to any claim that the devastation was incidental.
We are trying to avoid any kind of civil casualties.
Zaitun, also flattened by Israeli bulldozers. But in this house, they'd herded 100 members of the Samuni clan, and then they shelled it, killing 49 of them.
We are trying to avoid any kind of civil casualties.
It requires a stunning level of denial and self-delusion to pretend that the destruction which was achieved in Gaza had anything to do with Israel's security or the targeting of Hamas militants. This was savage and barbaric collective punishment unleashed on a civilian population, nothing less. Any suggestion to the contrary must be sharply and immediately ridiculed as absurd. This was arguably the first aerial bombing campaign ever conducted on a defenseless civilian population held captive within a fenced enclosure and not allowed to escape the assault. It is a measure of the cynical mindset of the Israeli military that leaflets were sometimes dropped in neighborhoods about to be bombed, suggesting the residents flee. We are about to destroy your home. You had better get out. Flee to where? Gazans are not allowed to leave their open-air prison, not even when under attack. This tactic on the part of Israel also gives the lie to the claim that homes and buildings were targeted because there were Hamas militants hiding inside them. Why then warn them to leave before destroying the structures? Given this litany of horror and the coldly premeditated nature of its execution, we must ask, what kind of society condones this level of brutality? What precedent is there for such monstrous disregard for the basic tenets of human decency? Unfortunately, we need look no further than the behavior of the United States, Israel's staunch supporter and mentor. In Iraq, the toll of U.S. militarism is well over 1 million lives, and a large part of the infrastructure of a nation of 26 million people has been ruined. And what of Gaza today, 1 year later? Israel's continued illegal siege, enabled by the United States and the U.S. client state, Egypt, has prevented any substantial amount of building material from entering Gaza. Essentially, no reconstruction has been possible. The people of Gaza live amidst the rubble created by Israeli hatred and aggression. They are attempting to rebuild their communities using mud bricks and whatever can be salvaged from the wreckage. The next time someone argues Israel has a right to defend itself or attempts to use the abusive spouse defense, look what you made me do.
They are forcing us to kill their children to defend our children.
Tell them no. Tell them there can never be any acceptable justification for the deliberate devastation of an entire society. It is unconscionable. It is wrong. Plainly put, there is no sane argument in favor of such behavior. Those who believe there is should be rebuked and must be vigorously opposed.
Later on. So it's going to be a collection of, say, your words before, because you always said things before, like, and it's hard for people to actually get involved in the mind. It's like being a fucking workplace that's really shitty if you're working. If you're in a university that's got a pretty shitty SU or something like that, there's no one there who's prepared to really help and support the miners. Where is other ways? Now, all over the bloody country, there's miner support groups springing up all over the place, right? And if you want to support the miners, if you can't bloody help them in any way, go to your bloody local miners support group, because it's the best way you're going to find that you can support the miners, as long as well as collecting in your workplaces, as long as bloody helping other people wherever you can. Go to miners support groups, collect in your workplaces, and put money in these bloody buckets for taking them home tonight.
So a chap London once said about scabs. It's only one colour, it's red, I'm sorry. Chap London once said, the scab is a two-legged creature with a corkscrew soul, a waterlogged brain, a combination backbone of jelly and glue. When good men have a heart, a scab just has a tumour of rotten principles, he knows it too. When a scab walks down the street, good men turn their backs, and the angels in heaven weep, and the devil shuts the gates of hell to keep them out. Those are the sort of human, the human scum that the Fleet Street shit sheets describe as heroes. There've been firefighters killed in the strike. There've been 7,000 arrests. There's 6 men on life support machines. There's been police attacking them on the picket line. And then they fucking talk about violence. Scholar, call a playful of hateful. Yeah.
This is Ralamata.
And Donna from EPSI.
And you're listening to a
Creative Commons licensed podcast.
Word.
This is FSNL reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
Only 28% of Americans believe in evolution.
62% want creation science taught along with evolution in our schools.
44% want creation science taught exclusively.
You are all about to learn that you didn't come from monkeys and slime. All of you were created in the image and likeness of God.
But didn't we evolve from prior organisms?
Yes, we did. Those organisms were named Adam and Eve.
Then why do we share 99% of our DNA with chimpanzees?
The Bible doesn't teach about chimpanzees.
What about redundant DNA, a junk DNA? Does the Bible teach about that?
Well, I can tell you one thing. There's no redundant DNA in hell.
Our children are our future.
Let's try not to turn them into dangerous idiots.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
And the Democrats are throwing the election away. For what? An inadequate black male who would not have been running had it not been a white woman that was running for president. I'm no second-class citizen. And goddamn the Democrats.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
Okay, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We're still talking with Krusty Alsop, and you really need to check out her Twitter feed, at Krusty Alsop.
Alsop.
I'm sorry, why don't you just spell it out?
Okay, it's K-R-U-S-T-Y, A-L-L-S-L-O-P.
Okay, so you'll know how to find it, and of course, we will link to her Twitter page when we release this dispatch. At least what I was trying to allude to is that the idea of Judeophobia in the Labour Party as an ideal is simply bollocks. Anybody who believes that is mad. And I will also link to this page, and this is from Paul Flynn.
Oh, no, Paul Flynn's a great MP. He's a really old school, he's a really old school, proper Labour, really decent MP. He's been an MP for years. He's a great guy.
Okay.
Really honest individual.
Well, we're going to link to a page that he has on his personal site, The Truth on Malicious Tory Hyperbole. You know, any anti-Semitism in the Labour Party is tiny and trivial, say 80 prominent Jewish members of the party. And he has a signed, listed statement up from the Jewish members of the Labour Party. Kate Adams, Julia Bard, Lavina Bassett, Shireen Benjamin, Rika Bird, Jenny Boone. There's too many names here for me to mention. And it's just, it's just nonsense the way they're going about this. And even though I did it in a very haphazard and loose way, I tried to explain some of the factors behind the questions that are not going to be raised in terms of that. But we're going to move on a little bit because really we're going to focus on the second half on what's happening with Labour. Now, Krusty was mentioning Farage and Johnson, but the timing of a lot of these things seems to happen around election time, whether it's India, whether it's France, whether it's Italy, whether it's the United States. You know, there seems to be a strange little pattern when the far right is desperate and know that they cannot win at the voting booth. They know that they can't win because if you listen to their policies, nobody will vote for them. So they have to do something else. They have to scare you. I mean, Krusty, I don't know about you, but in the States, you know, for a lot of us, George Orwell's 1984 seems to have been a training manual for these people. Rather than a warning, you know?
It does seem to be that way. I think it's very interesting that literally a week before... for months and months, ever since Jeremy Corbyn was elected, there's been like this, all this stuff up. Oh, you know, he's destroying the Labour Party, destroying the Labour Party so much that we've got now 400,000 members. We're the largest party in the country. And then, his popularity started rising and there's lots of people who are grassroots people, who's remembered that after all these years, but this really was a sort of grassroots movement. People were crying out and fearful after, we'd had 13 years of Labour under Blair and Gordon Brown. But prior to that, we'd had 18 years of what I would call fascism in this country under Margaret Thatcher. And it's been people have been very slow to catch on. They've been very slow to catch on because we have this situation where I think what Blair did was, as many kind of so-called social democrat neoliberals, you can call them that, they feed the middle class, they make noises in the right direction, but what they're actually doing is continuing a different kind of way forward with politics, which is, who knows? I mean, my favourite thing is to say, it's all going to be like Blade Runner at the end of the day.
That's not a pleasant thought.
No, it's not. It's not. You know, Tyrell Corporation. If only we had Ruth Gahoya. In a way, acting for it in a strange sort of way, but I don't want to go into the realms of that because it would take up too much time. I think that what we're having, what we're experiencing now, one of the few good things that we've had is that there are certain things that have been set in motion. If I allude to the Hillsborough inquiry now, that was set in motion by Andy Burnham. And it's very, it might be quite hard for people in the States to understand what actually happened there. But if I can just give you a bit of brief background.
Yeah, sure.
And why this is so devastating and why this absolute obnoxious crap about anti-Semitism has been so awful. Is that Margaret Thatcher had identified Liverpool and probably Manchester, but not quite so much Manchester, but Liverpool in particular, as one of the focuses of her absolute ire about destruction. And she wanted to make a huge example of the people of Liverpool. And my family are all from Liverpool, Liverpool Irish. So anyway, how can I say it? You know, you have certain allegiances to football teams and stuff like this. And I was a student at the time of the Hillsborough disaster, and I was listening to it on the radio. And the very next day, the Sun newspaper, which I'm sure you don't even, it's like the Fox News of, Maxwell was the Mirror, but I mean, you know, Maxwell, he fell off his boat. Like, pity that Rupert Murdoch can't fall off a boat somewhere, but you know, we can but dream. But it's a very long and complicated history, but let's put it this way. It was basically a massacre of people by negligence, and Margaret Thatcher was instrumental in the cover-up. And we've had this, finally, this inquest which has vindicated the football fans who were there, which there's been 27 years of lies against the Liverpool fans and supporters who were at that match, and 96 people were crushed to death. And I do recommend that people go to the Guardian website and look up Hillsborough and look up Justice for the 96 and have a look at some of the articles that describe in great detail about what actually happened there. We're talking people as young as 14 and 15 who were crushed to death at this football match, who were tainted as scum and drinkers and yobs and everything, and it was all their fault. And the police fabricated evidence on a grotesque scale. So it's a huge story that has the potential to sort of rock the establishment in this country. And the day after that happens, then we have this huge anti-Semitism row that breaks out across the media in this country. And I'm left wondering why that was the case. Why this particular time? Why just before elections, where we are about to, you know, potentially change things in this country, change things around and get some real sort of focus in, and I don't know, it's been extremely upsetting. Members of my family were at the football match, although they weren't trapped in the end of the football ground where these terrible deaths occurred. It's quite extraordinary that the whole focus and what this actually meant has been totally it's just been wiped away by this whole anti-Semitism row, which is it's a false focus. I personally think that there's something about that is very important, that we're not, that people in this country are not being allowed to see. You know, it's a huge diversionary tactic, in a way that, you know, I hate myself for saying this, but it's like every time there's a huge atrocity, you know, like as in, for instance, what was going on in Gaza in August 2014, where even American generals were horrified by what the Israelis were doing, the pulverizing of Gaza in 2014. And it's distraction, 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 distraction. And I mean, what does that say about what anti-Semitism is? If you can't describe the deliberate pulverization of people, and I include Hillsborough in this as well. How can you be a really decent human being? How can you have any idea about what is important and what is not? What does that say about you if you are prepared to buy into a diversionary tactic about anti-Semitism to preserve the status quo? This is what concerns me about this whole thing about Israel. And what is it as an entity? Why does it exist? I mean, it must be an awful country to live in. If you're Jewish, it must be a terrible country to live in, because there is it must be abnormal to live there, you know,
in terms of the Palestinians, they're fighting to survive. That's where their people are buried, so that's where they're from. And it's not as, I mean, they've always been Jews in the area, and they fairly got along. I mean, there was there are two racial incidences that I can remember that are on record between Arabs and Jews in Palestine, and they were both brief. Somebody on a religious tip got mad and killed some people, and it was like 3 days of fighting. And the second one was an act of one person who killed, I forget how many people. I'm being very vague about this because I don't remember the details. But it's not as if they were not living side by side. I mean, I've read narratives by people who were children during that period who said that, you know, during the first July, that for the most part, and she said, or at least the one I remember the most, she said, maybe it's just because we were children. We spoke each other's languages and we had to go to separate schools. But they talked, they played, they visited each other's stalls, you know, they're like, we didn't have a problem. So
I think that was the case in Palestine, because I'm going to say something. I have to be very careful because I have to preserve this person's integrity and identity. But I very recently met a very elderly Holocaust survivor, and he came from a very upper class Russian Jewish family, and he lost most of his family in the Holocaust, and I think pretty much all of them, including his parents, were wiped out. And he was because of the class he belonged to, he was saved in one way, but the devastating fallout that he has had to deal with has been no less than anybody else who didn't have the same amount of money or the same amount of no influence, but just it was just a question of being maybe able better to hide yourself, or, you know, there was had more access to different routes out of and to be saved. And and one thing that struck me about what he was saying, that his family, some of his family moved to, and he doesn't ever say Israel, he always says Palestine, which I thought was very interesting, and for him to say that. And also the other thing that he said was that, I don't want to give too much away because I have to preserve this person's integrity and identity, and I doubt whether he would be listening to this, but he might be, but or somebody from his family. But even so, I would say that he brought home to me the absolute abomination of what happened to the Jews in the Holocaust, but at the same time, what he brought home to me also was his absolute capacity for being a human being, and what makes me very, very angry and upset is the fact that we have a group of people in the fucking Labour Party who are abusing his experience without possibly ever having talked to anybody like him, a man in his 80s, an elderly man, and using that for political expediency to make some kind of case for preserving the status quo, where, as you quite rightly say, that we are looking at a very serious right-wing takeover of powerful, you know, about government, everything, you know, it's just beyond my scope of my understanding. But for people without knowing anything to do this is beyond the pale, really. And I know a lot of Jewish people who are Labour Party members, and ironically, because of the attacks on Sadiq Khan, who's standing for London Mayor, who's a working class Pakistani who became a human rights lawyer, the attacks by Zach Goldsmith in the right wing press in the UK, it sickens me, really. Sickening what's going on. And
well, I'm disturbed because I see it happening here in the US. The American Israel, you know, Political Action Committee, whenever they, you know, have an election here, you have to kind of go and pledge your fealty to them. There's a huge, I mean, we have people here who are living in the streets, who are living in their vehicles. We have infrastructure, bridges that need to be repaired. There's potholes in several cities that are really, really bad. You know, there's a lack of water. We have damage from fracking. There's not enough schools. But for some reason, they still have money to build prisons. They still have money for the military. And they still have money to give the Israeli state in terms of military aid.
Saudi Arabia as well, which is another crippling influence on the world, and they have all this money, and what they're doing is they're crippling us to feed some huge monster that's to do with a military, and it's ever more sophisticated. This is the thing that concerns me.
I mean, we have money that is going from the working class straight up to these, you know, to what we have here. Well, same thing in the UK, the military industrial complex.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be supporting any of this. And Saudi Arabia is already dripping in money. So why is the US, you know, and Britain supporting Saudi Arabia with what they're doing in the Yemen right now?
Well, this is the other thing as well. You know, there has been a total news blackout about what's happening in Yemen, and I can see what's happening. I haven't spent time to look at the entire situation that's going on in Yemen, but all I can see is it, and I've understood from other things that I've read, that there is some bizarre thing going on in Yemen, which is a weapons dump. I call it a weapons dump, and I think what Gaza is a weapons dump. They're testing out things, they're just dropping stuff, so they can just, you know, somebody can buy some more shit from somewhere else. And I don't know, not many people know this, but many, many years ago, I was doing a job working, selling advertising, and I got an invite to an arms fair, believe it or not. And I went in there with my pass, with another girl that I worked with, and I was quite young at the time, and it was the most bizarre thing that I had ever, ever been to in my life. It was like, you know the arms fairs that they have in, you know, they probably have them in America. They have the ones here where everybody demonstrates against. I had a pass to go into one of these arms fairs, okay? Just like walk in, pass. Because I was doing advertising for a property magazine, which was the most bizarre thing. And I was selling advertising, you know, basically selling white space. You know what white space is, you know, just basically selling fresh air. And for some reason, I went into an arms fair and I was working in this arms. I was at this arms fair. And I didn't, of course, I didn't have clearance to go into the real sort of rooms where they were selling the real heavy weaponry or anything like that. But it was very disturbing. And I remember that there was, this is going to sound biased, but there was a stand and they were Israeli people and they were selling bins that were bomb proof, and these guys were really nice. You know, the guys on this stand were like really nice people, really sort of seemed to be really okay people. But what they were selling, I mean, I don't know who they were selling this shit to, but it was like they were bomb proof bins, like litter bins. And I thought, well, I don't think that, I've just wondered, you know, joined dots and things like that. You have to wonder what actually goes on, you know, what we perceive as normal. There's a whole abnormal world that is also going on in tandem with our world. You know, oh, my cat is just scratching the sofa. Sorry.
Oh, it's okay.
Sorry. Hang on. But these were really nice people. They were in this arms fair, but they weren't the only ones. But that was the one that really struck me about this, like selling these bomb-proof bins. And I just thought, well, oh my God, it was like a whole world that I'd never seen before. I doubt very much now whether I would get into one of those places ever again. I probably wouldn't be allowed to get into them, but...
Yeah, so I guess one of the last things I'll ask you is, you know, now that you've brought in, you know, Hillsborough, and for those of us in the States, we would never have connected that to what's been going on with this Judeophobia scandal with labor. You know, now that we've talked a lot about this, do you think it's possible that the British public will come to realize the connection that you just made? Because, you know, I haven't heard Margaret Thatcher's name brought up in this at all. I haven't heard the Home Secretary's name brought up. I haven't heard about anybody who was in a position of responsibility that said anything other than, you know, blamed it on hooliganism, blamed it on fashionalism with Liverpool. It was like you just finished saying, you know, they were really trying to badjack Liverpool, and this was an opportunity for them to do so in a political sense.
I think it's very important, because, like, you know, with the Leveson inquiry, it has to be linked with the Leveson inquiry, and also the attacks against, you know, the miners' strike.
Mm-hmm.
And also this whole anti-Semitism thing. I mean, I understand where you're coming from in terms of from the States, and I understand what your concern is and your issue is. But in terms of, like, British politics here, we have a very we've been skating on thin ice for a long time, and I think this is I think this whole anti-Semitism thing is a massive smokescreen, because the BBC have taken it up. They've just been spouting this rubbish that doesn't even exist, that's like totally without context, without any sort of thing, any sort of proper discussion or real in-depth analysis at all. And it continues today, you know, today on in the newspapers and stuff, it's been pushed around as, you know, they've got even more crap that they're coming out with, which is just unfounded. And I think, how do I say it? I think that we are at a very dangerous point. I think we're at a very dangerous point. Because the entirety of it is about to be really exposed, and about how manipulative the entire system is, and how we are being controlled. You know, not just by. Let me put it this way: I think Israel is a very useful tool to control free speech. I think it's a very, very useful, powerful trigger to neuter free speech in this country, in America as well.
But see, but this is one thing that we really didn't get a chance to get into. Now, the neo-Nazi movement, unfortunately, they make it out in some of their publications and some of their speeches that they are 100% supportive of the Palestinians and their right to their own land and this, that, and the other. You know, while at the same time, the same literature, you know, demonizes Arab people. But those of us who have been following the far right for quite some time, and who remember Jacques Verguet, the French lawyer, the far right in Europe and the extreme, you know, Islamic ends, they've been working together for more than 30 years. And as I've written, those links go back to World War One, you know, in the extremist sense. Now, the people within their communities may not even know they exist. But, you know, again, with that, you know, a lot of that history that I peppered this conversation with, in my own admission, in a really haphazard way, what do we do in terms of trying to explain to those that are not cognizant, don't have any sort of understanding of the politics behind a lot of these issues, that there's a difference between Judeophobia and criticism of the State of Israel? You know, because the neo-Nazis use a lot of the same materials, and they try to make it seem like they give a damn about Palestinians, when really they're using this as a front for their Judeophobia to justify their hatred.
Well, I think that's a really interesting point, because I think that, as far as from what I can see, that what we have in this country here is a sort of bizarre sort of far right adherence to the whole idea of Israel as the most, it's like sanctified ground. You know, you can't say anything against the State of Israel. And, you know, quite a few years ago in a pub that I used to go into, that I said one thing and somebody said to me, oh, you're this, you're that, you hate Jews, whatever. And I thought, what do you mean? You know, I mean, I was like so shocked that this guy said this to me. But I think I don't know if it's the same in America as it's the same as here. But here, I don't know. I think that there's a sort of weird, there's a weird conflagration between these ideologies, if you like. And I'm really not quite sure how it all works out. I'm trying to sort of understand it, but I find it very difficult. But I think what we have is before you go, I do have to mention the royal family. You know, like, we have that very famous footage from The Sun, which is like right wing, which, you know, which was the leader of pushing Margaret Thatcher's thing that, you know, the Hillsborough disaster was caused by yobbish fans and all the rest of it. But at the same time, we had this, you know, that same paper published footage of the Queen, her sister, Princess Margaret, and the Queen Mother, the most fervent of Nazis, giving Nazi salutes at Balmoral. We have this kind of weird disconnect that nobody's nobody's talking about. You know that we also, you know, you're a republic. Lucky you. Yeah, I know you don't have really. I know it doesn't really work like that. We have this kind of so-called democratic state here, but we don't. We have, you know, the most brutal advocates of Nazism against the Jews were the British royal family and the aristocracy. So, you know, it's very, very, very complicated, I think. I don't know.
You know, it's a historical fact that the Duke of Windsor and Wallace Simpson spent many, many, many visits at the Berchtesgaden, you know, with Hitler. So
Prince Harry, you know, Prince Harry was photographed in a Nazi uniform with stickers on his shoulders, and you know, what was all that about? And Tory MPs at parties giving Heil Hitler salutes. And I mean, somebody can come back to me and tell me if they've ever seen any member of the Labour Party dressed up in a Nazi uniform giving a Heil Hitler salute, or, you know what I mean?
I can't even imagine it.
I mean, it would be so ridiculous, but this is what the British press are now accusing Jeremy Corbyn of, to bring it back to that point. And Ken Livingston, you know, they're saying Ken Livingston may be this person who's just sort of like... And he, as far as I know, there's no footage of Ken Livingston or Jeremy Corbyn stood somewhere in a party, you know, with a Nazi uniform on giving a Heil Hitler salute. But this is what they're basically being accused of. Yeah, our own royal family, even including one of the Queen's grandsons, has been doing this. You know?
it's just nuts. But, you know, really, Krusty, all slop. Thank you.
All slop. I know that was, well, but yeah, I'll tell you about that another time, about the origins of my name, my Twitter name.
Okay, you do that, but I definitely want you folks to go visit her, Krusty All Slop. Check her out on Twitter, and you know, really see what she's about, and she seems to be about Cartesian common sense, fairness, justice. She's also a musician.
Thank you.
And you know, you really need to see what she's doing. And thank you for being on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Okay, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Okay, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please, stay tuned.
These guys are the masters at it.
This is Rebecca Pierce. I'm a journalist and filmmaker from the San Francisco Bay Area. You can find me at weirdsister.tv, and this is Aboriginal Radio.
George Galloway, who's in Westminster for us this morning, and you may remember back from last year, it was Mr. Galloway who was up against Naz Shah, the MP that started this whole row with those comments you made before she was elected. Good morning to you. Look, is this indicative of a problem within the Labour Party, a party of which you used to be a member?
Well, you call it a problem. Naz Shah's, frankly, half-witted scribblings were before she was an MP, and they were on Facebook. They were not like the two Palestinian children that were shot down dead in Jerusalem yesterday and left lying on the street like stray dogs. This is an entirely synthetic crisis. Ken Livingston said absolutely nothing wrong. Everything he said was the truth. Historical fact. Proven. I've got the books. So should you. There was an agreement between the Nazi filth of Hitler and the Zionist leaders in Germany to send Germany's Jews to Palestine, because both of them believed that the German Jews were not German and that they were aliens. Even if they'd been there for centuries, they must leave. So in that sense, Nazism and Zionism were two sides of the same coin. They even actually minted a coin to prove it, to celebrate the Havara Agreement, which was reached. Now, should Ken Livingston have gone round the studios saying that? I think not. I wouldn't have, neither on timing, nor would I have used the words and the imagery that he used. But you can't be expelled for telling the truth. Oh, wait. That's what happened to me over Iraq.
Okay, Natasha Devons here in the studio, George. She wants a word.
I just wanted to ask you, if this is, as you claim, a synthetic crisis that's been fabricated out of a few ill-judged Facebook comments, then why do you think it's happening now? Why is it advantageous to attack the Labour Party now, in your opinion?
They're trying to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn. That's the long and the short of it. There's a slow-motion coup. It has been underway for many months. The real target is Jeremy Corbyn. And you'll see that this chaos, which has been created, you just saw it by Labour MPs screaming Nazi scum at other big Labour figures like Livingstone. They will say, with all this chaos, we can't go on like this. We need a new leader who can command the support of members of Parliament and those parts of the media that has been hysterically anti-Corbyn from the very beginning. So it's a coup. Corbyn is the target. Sadiq Khan and John Mann and the other voices that have been heard so loudly over the last 24 hours, they're at the heart of that coup. You see if I'm right.
You said, George, that Ken Livingstone was actually right in his assertions. And look, that is a point that could be up for argument. A lot of people on Twitter claiming that as well. But the idea, which he effectively putting that Hitler was a Zionist, that he was supporting the idea of building a Jewish homeland, that can't be validated, can it? I mean, he may have wanted them all out of his country before policy changed and they decided to exterminate 6 million Jews, but the idea that he was actually a Zionist can't be stood up, surely.
Ken Livingstone never said it. It's one of those things that seems to have passed already in a day into myth. He never said that Hitler was a Zionist. That would be absurd. Hitler was not a Zionist. The Zionists were not Nazis. But in 1933, they concluded what was effectively a treaty that the German Jews would be transported to Palestine. And that is the Zionist project. They also don't believe that German Jews are German. Jews are French, or British Jews are British. They believe that they are aliens and they should go and live in somebody else's country. And that's what the Nazi filth believes too. Even now, today, there are people on the far right who believe that.
But
so
what he actually said, I mean, to quote him verbatim, if I can find it now, Hitler was supporting Zionism.
That doesn't mean he was a Zionist, but he was supporting Zionism. And that's a fact. It's a historical fact. Every scholar, including Israeli scholars and including Jewish scholars, will tell you that. But in this firestorm, this synthetic firestorm, in this smokescreen, all of that has been lost and it's now accepted with regret in some cases or with I told you so in others, that Ken Livingstone somehow is an anti-Semite. His entire life has been spent fighting racism of all kinds. Indeed, he'd still be the Labour mayor of London if he hadn't gone so out on a limb to defend minorities in London and to stand up against anti-racism.
Okay, but whatever your view on that key issue, there's a problem for Labour, isn't there, in the way it's been handled by Jeremy Corbyn, whether you think he should be backing Ken Livingstone or sacking Ken Livingstone. It's a bit of a fudge at the minute, isn't it?
No, he did what the news media has been demanding that he do, which is summarily evict Ken Livingstone, one of the giant figures of the British left, out of the Labour Party. So I don't think you can say that he's been in any way fudging. He's just done the wrong thing. He's done the precise opposite of the wrong thing. I tweeted before all this happened, yesterday morning, if you don't run, they can't chase you. He did run, and my goodness, you are all chasing him.
George Galloway, we have to leave it there. Thank you for your thoughts on that.
Thank you. حفظه شايف السماء شو بعيد بعد السماء بحفظه كبر البحر وبعد السماء بحبك يا حبيبي يا حبيبي يا حبيبي بحبك
فكين الحبايب شوفيني يا طير يا طير روحي سألوا نعلي وليفوا مسمعوا مجروح بجروح الهوى شو بينفعوا موجوع ما بيقول علي بيوجعوا وتعن عبالوا ليالي الولداني يا طير يا طير يا طير على اطراف الدنيا لو في تحكي للحبايب شوفيني يا طير يا طير
Soames. I'm the Member of Parliament for Mid Sussex, and I am the grandson of Winston Churchill. I've decided to lend my strongest possible support to this campaign because I am appalled by the dishonesty and the disgraceful way in which the British National Party have used Churchill's name, particularly during the European election, where they used his face, his features, his words as promotional literature, trying to pretend that Churchill would have admired and supported the aims of the British National Party. What they have done is not only dishonest and irresponsible, but it's downright misleading to try and pretend that Churchill would have had any sympathy with the British National Party, whatever. He would, I can assure you, have loathed everything that they stand for. Churchill led a national government. He was acutely conscious, as Britain's war leader, of the need to have a national government, to bring all parties together. And yet what the BNP seek to do is to divide all parties, to bring division and upset and lack of coherence to our communities by driving wedges between people. That is the exact opposite of everything that Churchill wanted to do in the national government. This is a peaceful country, and what they bring to it is uncertainty, fear, and confusion. There is absolutely nothing that is British about the BNP.
Nothing British is a campaign against racism and extremism. Add your voice by signing our petition at www.nothingbritish.com.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
We are the Ku Klux Klan. We hate niggers, we hate Jews, we hate faggots, and we hate specs. We people need to get off your ass and wake up. This is America.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, Native women made all decisions regarding their reproductive health care. This was respected as women's business. Today, we are basically denied this decision-making power. It's time to take back that power of making decisions concerning our reproductive health. There is a choice we can make regarding unwanted pregnancy. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that must be taken within 72 hours after having unprotected sexual intercourse in order for it to be effective in preventing pregnancy. Contact your local Indian Health Service facility and ask if they carry Plan B. If not, tell them to order it. Plan B is an OTC, over-the-counter contraceptive, and a prescription is not necessary. You have a legal right to access this contraceptive over-the-counter. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
I've been affected by gun violence over the years. It's through deaths of friends and family members and associates.
When I was 5 years old, I was held at gunpoint in a home invasion.
I've gone to the juvenile detention centers and I've met dozens of young kids, babies really, who have been affected by gun violence.
Directly, I've lost a few friends, but I think what why this touches my heart is having children of my own.
You know, I've been at parties where, you know, I had just left the party and, you know, maybe 10, 15 minutes later, you know, I heard that, you know, somebody got shot and didn't make it.
There are a lot of people benefiting off of our pain, and it's time we do something.
I'm here to unload my investment because I think that it's important that we start kind of seeing where our money is going.
It's time to go to your financial advisor and demand that there are no gun investments in your 401k.
Even if you don't have investments, you can still help spread the word.
This is something everyone can do.
So if you push your people that have 401ks, it might be your grandma, it might be your cousin, this effort can make a big impact.
I'm unloading for my loved ones that I lost.
I'm unloading for my 18-year-old self.
I'm unloading my 401k for the future of my children.
I'm unloading.
I'm unloading for my family and their future.
I'm unloading so that my daughter can grow up in a safe, loving world.
Unload and join the movement.
Use hashtag I'm unloading to pledge your support for gun-free investing.
This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Head on RadioNetwork.com, an internet-based conversation radio experiment. Available most easily at headonradionetwork.com. There's a listen live button. Just jump right on it, and there you are. Or if you're on a mobile device, it's also easy to find us at TuneIn Radio, a nice app for your mobile smartphone, or Tuner Internet Radio, or Dar.fm, or Stitcher Radio, Streama.com. We are rather ubiquitous. I mean, if we got more every night, we'd be paying salaries, right? Head on RadioNetwork.com.
Palestine is one of the most reported places in the world.
But there's still a lot of misinformation about the reality on the ground.
What much of the media fails to explain
is that since 1948, nearly 75% of the entire indigenous Palestinian population
have been forcibly driven off our land
to make room for the creation of the so-called State of Israel.
And we are denied the right to return to our homeland.
The remaining 25% of Palestinians live as second-class citizens in the State of Israel, or under a brutal military occupation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
While the world powers fund and support Israel,
we, the people of the world, in our millions,
support the Palestinian people's struggle for freedom and equal rights.
If I boycott Israeli goods.
If I boycott Israeli goods.
If I boycott Israeli goods.
It's because I oppose an illegal occupation.
Because I oppose racism.
Because I oppose brutality towards the indigenous people of their land. I reject the notion that I am anti-Semitic.
I reject the notion I'm a self-hating Jew, simply because I oppose the idea of an exclusively Jewish state.
There is only one line of division.
It's not a line of division between Muslims and Jews.
It's not a line of division between Palestinians and Israelis.
It is a line of division.
It is a line of division.
It is a line of division between those who stand for the equality of all.
And those who stand for the supremacy of some. Boycott apartheid.
Boycott Israel.
Boycott apartheid.
Boycott Israel.
Boycott apartheid. Boycott Israel.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
This ends our news flash.
Je sais qu'il partait.